What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hey everybody, welcome to It Never Rains on this podcast. I'm Hitzel Day, and the managing editor for Addicted to Quack. It's a website. Joining me this week is one of the great writers from ATQ, Badwater. How you doing?
Doing good. Pinch hitting for our other writer, which is what all good teams do. Because it was originally supposed to be Slurms this week.
That's true, but then something came up on at the last minute, and we had to reschedule. So I'm happy to talk to you because you have one of the more exciting articles that I think is going to appear this month, which is Oregon may have solved its pitching problem in the softball team with an incoming transfer. You're going to be writing her up on for an article to be published on Saturday. Why don't you give us a little sneak preview?
Well, the pitcher is Morgan Scott. She's a pitcher of University of North Carolina, Greensboro, who has really been outstanding in the Southern Conference and in Southern Conference action ever since she started as a freshman in 2020. She had somewhat more limited pitching in 2020. And that was probably because of the pandemic, and they undoubtedly cut down their games. And, you know, 2020 is a lost season for most of the NCAA sports anyway. But she really, in the 2021 season, came on board and pitched most of the season. For the past two seasons, she's basically been Greensboro's ace. She won the Pitcher of the Year and the Freshman Player of the Year honors in the 2021 season, as she was kind of instrumental in leading Greensboro to the Southern Championships and into the NCAA tournament. Last year, we would have, those of us who have followed Duck softball would have seen her, because we went to, the Ducks went to North Carolina to play Greensboro. And
how the Ducks do in that game?
It was a tight game. That was, I believe, the longest game that we played last year in terms of innings. It went to 10 innings.
Yeah.
Because they were tied 4-4 going into the ninth. And up to that point, Scott had pitched 6 of 9 shutout innings against the Oregon Bats. Well, you know, asking a pitcher to pitch 10 innings in softball is a stretch. And the Oregon Bats finally lit up Greensboro in the 10th inning, got 8 unanswered runs. And that was a little more than Greensboro could be expected to respond to, you know, because it was great Oregon team. They had great bats last year. But her pitching is very good. Last year, I believe her record was 25-12 with a 2.28 ERA. And the thing about Morgan Scott is she throws a lot of strikes. She knows where the strike zone is at and will hit it. And she showed last year against Oregon, you know, just how good a pitcher that she is. And I think it's a fantastic get for Lombardi. It's just what Oregon needs.
Yeah, I found a recording of that game and watched some of Scott. It was yeah, she's really got control over pitch. Like that's probably the number one thing I'm looking for in a softball pitcher is just control. Like I, you know, especially given that, you know, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Oregon's, you know, bullpen right now looks like, you know, Hansen and Scott, and that's it.
Yeah. It is the others are additions that we haven't really seen very much of or none of and are unproven. So the addition of Scott was on a scale of 1 to 10. That's about as 10 as you can get.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. You know, do you think that Oregon is done in the transfer portal in terms of more pitchers? I mean, they need a bigger bullpen than this. Do you think that they can rely on, you know, taking a relative unknown out of what they've got, or do you think they need to get somebody else?
Well, I think that even if they have an existing pitcher that they're, you know, pretty high on, they need another pitcher. It'd be really nice to get another experienced pitcher in that pitching room. And that's the thing about Scott. She's thrown a lot of games and a lot of pitches and a lot of strikes. And so, you know, if we could add another, you know, minor conference, if you will, pitcher with that kind of resume, that'd be fantastic.
Do you suppose it transfers over? You know, it's going up a division. Like, any reason to think that, like, oh, maybe this isn't going to work out in the bigs?
Well, I would have thought so had Scott not pitched against Oregon last year. And the Southern Conference tends to go up against the better conferences quite a bit, even during their regular season. So, you know, it's something that Greensboro wasn't limited to, you know, just playing Oregon. She was their ace against a number of good teams last year, and she's a solid pitcher.
Well, we'll look forward to your article on Saturday. I'm sure you'll get into some more detail, you know, about her history and some of those other teams. I mean, it would probably be the number one thing that I'd be, you know, a little concerned about is just like, you know, how's this going to, you know, translate? But, you know, experience is experience. And, you know, it seems like just an absolutely dynamite addition. I'll look forward to reading your article on Saturday. Yep. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll keep talking about transfers, but we'll switch sorts to football. All right, we are coming off of two articles that you've written running down all the transfers coming into Oregon, both the offense and the defense. You got pretty deep on the offensive side. You got a bunch of walk-ons in there, some of whom are actually pretty exciting and might get some serious playing time. Boy, I can tell you from my preview series, there's a lot of the dudes that you mentioned as transfer walk-ons to Oregon, you know, who are just trying, like, you know, they're chasing glory. I'm not trying to be pejorative. It's just like, I want to go to a better school and show off what I got. And if I have to walk on to do it, then I'm willing to do that. Like, you know, first of all, good for you, dude. And second of all, I can tell you, there's a lot of programs in the Pac-12 to be throwing those dude scholarships who, like, need those guys. You know, and it's a nice sign of how full the cupboard was left for Dan Lanning that there are that many, you know, scholarship caliber athletes who have elected to transfer into and walk on for Oregon. There are so many of them that we're just, you know, not going to have time to discuss them. Listener, you should read Badwater's article. It's still up on Addicted to Quack. Let's talk about some of these scholarship guys. You know, obviously the most notable is Bo Nix. You know, I've written a little bit about him. You have too. What do you think? You think he's, you know, deadlocked for starter, or what's your take on the guy?
Well, I do think he has pole position on the starting job. And I think I would respond to that by saying that what I hope we see this year is a coaching staff that isn't dead set on using just Bo Nix. That when... If Bo Nix gets the starting position, I would hope that they would rotate in Thompson and Butterfield and give those guys some experience.
Well, I mean, he's publicly stated that he, you know, he wants, even though he has a bunch of eligibility remaining because he started playing as a true freshman in 2019 and 2020 didn't count. So, like, I think he still has like three to play two remaining. Yeah. But he has said that, you know, this is going to be his last year playing college ball. So, you know, if nothing else than just some getting them some experience, like, and also, you know, I'm with you that if like, you know, it's a full bullpen, you know, like if he's losing control of his pitch, you know, put in the relief, you know what I mean?
Yep. Yeah. And there's no reason to have that kind of talent in your backups, you know, doggedly on the side. And who knows? The starting position may be more up for grabs than we realize.
Well, it provides you know, it's a nice floor, right? Like that's always the case when you have like young studs and then a transfer older guy coming in. Is it like, okay, you know, the older guy, you know, gives you a floor, and if he gets beat out by the stud, awesome. And if he doesn't, it's still fine. You know, like that, I've always thought this was a good position to be in. Like a bunch of other, there are a bunch of other positions in football where I'm like, boy, if you're relying on transfers at that position, there's something wrong with your pipeline. Like offensive line is the most notable of those, but like, quarterback, I sort of feel like it's the other way around. It's just like having a you know, an older, you know, more experienced guy come in and then have to fight out for the job with younger guys. Like I am increasingly viewing that as like not just like healthy, but like the norm. Like that seems to be something that most high level programs are doing. You know what I mean? Right.
Yeah. And the Ducks have been fortunate the past few seasons, three, four seasons, when it comes to quarterback injuries. So, I mean, you just never know if your starting quarterback is going to be sidelined for however many games with an injury. And if you have talented backups, you know, you can rest them properly.
The running backs, the portal giveth, the portal taketh away. Travis Dye and Trey Benson transferred out. But they got a bunch of guys transferred in. A couple of, as I mentioned, transfers from other programs who walked on, Kealohana, Hassan Ritter, and Bryson Cobbins. But the really interesting, to me, guys were Marquise Irving, who came from Minnesota. Interestingly enough, his offensive coordinator, Mike Sanford Jr., is now going to be the OC at Colorado, so he'll get to see his old OC at a game this year. And then Noah Whittington, who came in from Western Kentucky, along with Oregon's new running backs coach, Carlos Lachlan. You know, Oregon returned Byron Cardwell and Sean Dollars. They got a four-star, a true freshman, you know, Jordan James. So it's not like, you know, they had nobody in the running back room. And frankly, if they took zero transfers, I think this running back room would still be fine. It'd be a little thin, but it'd be fine. So, like, I sort of view these guys as, like, this is depth. This is, like, healthy competition. But it's not like, oh my God, light your hair on fire. Something's wrong with Oregon's running backs room. What do you think about that take?
Well, yeah, I would agree with that. Certainly the walk-ons are, go in that area of, what's needed for depth, and they may or may not contend with, being in the top rotation. But they don't really need to. They'll have some time to prove themselves. We saw what Noah Woodington did in the spring game, and he performed well. Of course, given the limited number of run plays that Oregon did in the spring game, that's hardly a barometer. And I think I mentioned that in the article, but I'm really interested in seeing what Irving will bring in the fall, because unlike the others, this is a Power Five running back that has some respectable enough numbers in a Power Five conference.
I would say very. I mean, it's 5.3 yards per carry, which is above the threshold for like that's good for a running back. And like I mentioned, he's coming from Mike Sanford's system. That's a power run like jumbo set. Like I'm not joking. Like I had to do Minnesota film study because they played Ohio State right before Oregon played Ohio State, and they played Colorado a couple of games before Oregon played Colorado. So I wound up watching a good deal of Minnesota's film, and like that's they're not trying to like break off enormous runs. That's not like Chip Kelly's run game. That's like, old school Stanford's, run game. Not exactly a you, never mind. It's a power run game. I was about to launch into some real football nerd stuff, but anyway, they're 5.3 in that system is real good because that's a hammering a nail. Like that's a tap 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 kind of running system, not a shooting off giant runs and then get back to passing. So like, yeah, I'm with you. I want to see it, like especially like he takes 133 carries in a power run game. You know that he's like that's a built dude. Like that dude's built for contact.
Right, and he led Minnesota in all-purpose yards with 966. So,
Right, he had 73 yards receiving, and then played on special teams as well.
Yeah, and so he represents a pass threat out of the backfield, and who knows, he might be a return guy for us as well this coming season.
I wound up doing some film study on Noah Whittington just because I wrote an article about Carlos Lachlan, and I know that I've talked about Carlos Lachlan on this podcast before because I wrote that article, and then whoever was on was asking me about it. But like, the thing that was remarkable to me about Whittington was that Carlos Lachlan took over Western Kentucky's running back room. The head coach remained, but he changed up the offensive coaching staff because he didn't like what he was seeing. And so he inherited when Lachlan inherited Western Kentucky's running back room, it was a mess. There were two defensive players on it. There were guys who should have been getting carries who weren't getting carries. He completely rearranged the room, grabbed a couple of guys from like obscurity, cleared out the defensive players. And I was seeing like a four back rotation. Noah Whittington was the lead back in it. But the thing that was, remarkable was that like all four backs were running the same way. Like they were, if I didn't know those were different guys and like had different numbers on their jerseys, I would think that they were the same person because like the way that they, the way they made their cuts, the way that they protect the ball, the way that they would go into contact, all of these things looked, totally the same. And going from a room that like was a total mess, and a lot of those guys hadn't played college football before. They were football players. They hadn't gotten any carries in college before. to like all of these guys run identically, you know, it indicates to me that like Carlos Lachlan really makes a strong impression on his running backs, and that, you know, the dude he approved of the most was Noah Whittington, and surprise, surprise, Oregon got him. I actually have pretty high hopes for Whittington, and like Byron Cardwell better look out for his job. You know, is what, you know, I think a lot of people have him penciled in because like he looked real good, you know, last year. He does have the highest yard per carry average of any of Oregon's running backs, you know, period, both the new guys and the departing guys. He had 6.8 yards per carry last year, which like that's a really good number. That's a really good number. Travis Dye only had 6.0. CJ Verdell only had 5.2. So like, yeah, I feel like comfortable saying that Byron Cardwell, you know, is probably in, to use your term, pole position. But like Irving Whittington could, it would not surprise me, not in the slightest, if this were a 3 or 4 man rotation, and that if like Cardwell doesn't wind up having the greatest number of carries by the end of the year. That's sort of my take on the room. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah. Like we were talking about, with quarterbacks and quarterback depth, you maybe even more so with your running backs, you want that kind of depth and want to be able to rotate. Yeah. I would say that if Oregon's rotating 3 and 4 backs regularly this coming season, then Oregon is in a fantastic place with their running back room.
Oregon took a number of wide receivers through the transfer portal. Again, you know, one guy who's walking on, Malachi Russell. But the two Power Five transfers are Chase Cota from UCLA. Although that's sort of a returning home thing. That's an Oregon family right there. And Caleb Chapman from Texas A&M. I figure that most Duck fans are somewhat familiar with Chase Cota. So why don't you tell me a little more about Chapman?
Well, Chapman has spent all his time as Texas A&M, and he was a 4-star that performed really well when he was healthy. The unfortunate thing for Chapman is that in 2 of his 4 seasons at Texas A&M, they were cut short by season-ending injuries early in the year. When he's healthy, he can do really well. And as I said in my article, it was his injury in the 2020 season that was, I wouldn't say disappointing. I would say it was, had to have been disappointing for him, because he was just off on a tear those first 3 games with catches and yards and yards per catch, and really showed what he could be doing. Last year he wasn't quite so hot, but you know, in terms of just the numbers. But, you know, it's hard to say, you know, I can't speak to how he was used or, you know, how he was recovering from his injuries and that kind of thing. But he's a tall receiver. He's 6'5".
Yeah, I mean, can't teach height. I really like how much height Oregon has added to its wide receiver room. Like all throughout the Chip Kelly era, it was, you know, the plucky 5'11 guys, the like, you know, I'm 6'2" if I'm standing on my cleats on right out of bed with my hair combed. And like, yeah, man, you know, Chase Cota is 6'4", Caleb Chapman 6'5", you know, talk about the fresh, you know, Thornton 6'5", Brevard 6'4", Crocker and Franklin are, I think, 6'3" each, you know, like, yeah, some actual height in the outside receivers. And I believe, you know, I saw, you know, some photos from practices, like, I think the Chapman's all of 6'5". Like, I don't think that's one of these football exaggerations where it's like, oh, he's 6'4¼" and we rounded that up. Like, nah, man, like that guy might be closer to 6'6". Like, he's big.
Yeah. And it, even though he may find himself playing a bit of a role position, like the red zone, for example, they have enough other big threats that that's not necessarily a consideration. But it's good to have all these top-notch receivers, you know, available to, you know, reach up and pluck sideline passes over cornerbacks on the sideline.
Well, yeah. The other thing that I like about Taken Height is that they had already taken height, right? Like all of the, you know, the trio of 2021 recruits, the Franklin and Thornton and Brevard, who are all like 6'3 or bigger, like, hey, buddy, you don't get to automatically have the job just because you're tall. You know, right? Like Oregon's going to keep taking tall dudes, you know, isn't going to get two experienced ones out of the transfer portal. And, you know, like, you know, hey, hotshot, you know, you might be on the bench, you know, like, let's see how tall you are when you're sitting down, you know, like the iron sharpens iron is where I'm going with this, is that like, I like that there's competition. I like that people don't automatically win jobs just because of their physical dimensions and they actually got to earn it and play for it. And like, yeah, man, I dig it. Like I dig that they're, you know, it's looking like 6, maybe 7, if you count Casper, the dude who reclassified from 2023 and will join in the fall, like legit dudes over 6'3" who can catch the ball, of whom, you know, like all of them have caught the ball except for Casper, of course, in a college uniform before. Like, yeah, man, I don't like, I actually, you know, I've been a Duck fan for a while. I don't think Oregon's ever been in this position before. Like with this much size and talent in the outside wide receivers, I think this is like truly unique in the history of Oregon football, isn't it?
Yep. And to really appreciate what the Ducks have built up in a wide receiver core, all we have to do is think about past seasons where a singular 6'5" wide receiver on an opposing team just chewed us up.
Yep.
So, yeah, now it's our turn.
Last offensive, I sort of put that in quotes, a transfer that Oregon took is a kicker from Wazoo.
Yes, Andrew Boyle. And
who's also 6'3". He could play wide receiver in a pinch.
Yeah. Yeah, another big guy. But he has a big leg. You know, in the article I posted, I threw on a Twitter feed of him doing a practice 72-yard field goal, which was just incredible.
And it doesn't like barely make it either. That would have been good for 75,
and it had initial height to it too. It's not like he's line driving the thing.
Yeah,
it's an incredible kick, and kind of reminded me of Siegel warming up. Back in the day when, you know, he would regularly kick 55, 60, 65-yard practice field goals. And we really haven't had a place kicker quite like him since. So, and the Boyle's on a full scholarship. And, you know, I can see that why the Ducks would do that, because it's really exciting to have that kind of offensive potential in your pocket. You know, now you don't necessarily have to automatically punt on a, you know, when you're at the opponent's 40 or 45 yard line.
I tell you what, I also like taking them from Wazoo. yeah. You know, just like I like taking Kota from UCLA. All right, let's take a break. We come back, we'll keep talking about football, but we'll talk about some of the guys on the other side of the Columbia. So I published my long awaited article on the Washington Huskies football team. I as predicted, I got a few drive-by comments telling me what a fool I am and how I don't do my homework. That's you know, my greatest flaw is I really don't do any research for these at all. I you know, Washington's, I think Washington is going to be an interesting team. Earlier in the offseason, I wrote up, because I have to do this anyway, because I keep an entire, you know, Pac-12 player database, I calculated out what the average talent rating is for each team in the Pac-12, you know, including all the guys that they, you know, are taking in as transfers and as freshmen and so forth, which like nobody else does. It's actually kind of weird. And like the 247 releases and a talent composite, but they use their diminishing returns formula. There's some nerdy math there. It's not just a pure average. I just do a pure average. Washington was the number three most talented team in the conference in 2020. In 2021, and they are still the number three most talented team in the conference in 2022, but they took like a huge, you know, step back. And the only reason they stay number three is because the other like nine teams in the conference are just like, don't recruit at all. Like it's Oregon and USC, and then big step back Washington, and then real big step back Stanford, UCLA, Utah, ASU, you know, and then you're really getting to the dregs in the bottom half of the conference where it's like, you're really starting to look like teams that recruit like Mountain West teams. So, you know, the nature of Washington's talent fall off was just sort of astonishing. Like I calculated out over like a 2-year average count the blue chips, you know, count the number of 4 and 5 stars in and 4 and 5 stars out of the program. It's just gobsmacking. It's a net loss of 13 blue chips over the last two seasons, the Jimmy Lake seasons, which is it's crazy. It's only 7 blue chips in and 20 blue chips out. And then there's 4 more who are like, they were in and out within that 2 years. They had a quarterback who was like that anyway. Their recruiting has really cooled off, that, you know, and it seems to still be, you know, pretty cold, in 2023, like they're celebrating guys who would have Oregon fans panicking, in their 2023 class. And just like the exodus of blue chips out of Washington is just absolutely remarkable. And yet they still retain this like talent cushion over much of the conference, you know, and they face such a soft schedule next year. Like I even though I think they're going to have real problems and they were like 4-8 last year, I still think they sort of easily skate to 5 conference wins just on the residual talent. Like, and I just spent all of that time talking about like the talent exodus at Washington, but there's still like such a baseline of talent that they put together, over the Chris Peterson era, that like, that, you know,
The Jimmy Lake era really hurt them in terms of coaching. God, what a dumpster fire.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was obviously awful. And I mean, I'll pat myself on the back a bit. Like I was waving the red flag when the first several hires and fires that he made, when he took over, in that 2020 offseason, I was like, why are you firing the really good tight ends coach and replacing him with your drinking buddy? Or I don't know if he's a drinking buddy. That was just being colloquial. Why are you moving the one good defensive line coach to, coach linebackers? Like, why did you retain this dude and this dude and this dude who are clearly incompetent? Why did you get this dude as your offensive coordinator? Like, it's one of the dangers of, hiring a guy who basically never made any connections before. It's like he didn't have a Rolodex, and so like the best he could find for offensive coordinator was John Donovan, that was a disaster, and like everybody saw it coming. As I say every week, you know, when we talk about other teams, we're really just talking about Oregon. Dan Lanning had a Rolodex, man. Like,
mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Dan Lanning got to hire, a pretty, primo coaching staff, not the sexiest names in the world. And so a lot of like other fan bases sort of snigger, like, oh, that guy can't coach. I've never heard of him before. And then I did my series and I was like, actually, this guy's pretty good. But Carlos Lachlan, for example, was like, oh, look, they had to hire a guy who'd only had 1 year of coaching experience. Like, I bet a bunch of Pac-12 teams would love to have Carlos Lachlan right about now. I examining the Jimmy Lake experience made me all the more thankful that Dan Lanning, A, had a Rolodex and was able to assemble a real coaching staff, not just a bunch of like, you know, hacks and cronies like Jimmy Lake did, and holdovers from a dead ass staff. And B, that he didn't give himself the like, oh, we're just going to need a little time on the field to demonstrate success before we really get recruiting rolling. You know, Dan Lanning goes and recruits, you know, five stars immediately, you know, like dude has never coached a game as a head coach and is pulling five stars. Like, you know, like he, you know, no excuses with that dude. And Jimmy Lake was like lots of excuses, you know, that was,
yeah. And not five stars just on the defense, because you were a defensive coordinator for last season's championship team. No, we're talking offensive five stars.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah. You know, everything, you know, I know that this is an Oregon site that is talking about Washington. And so, yes, we're going to throw some shade. And I know that it may be a little annoying to, you know, that our catchphrase here is whenever we're talking about other teams, we're always talking about Oregon. But like, you know, with that, those caveats said, the differences in culture and roster composition and talent profile and willingness to play young players and not just sit back and let your, you know, senior Jags, you know, be your starters. Like the differences in culture and coaching and everything about Oregon and Washington are very, very different. And it's, you know, it throws into stark relief, you know, what Oregon is doing, that, you know, to study Washington, you know, it was actually, you know, a fairly illuminating and enjoyable process, you know, even though I had to watch a bunch of purple, and, you know, you know, Oregon's got a three-man quarterback race. Washington's got a three-man quarterback race. If any of Oregon's three quarterbacks were suddenly in Seattle, it wouldn't be a race. That dude would be the dude, you know, like Washington's got like, you know, oh, that guy's got one thing going for him, but he's also got this really serious knock on him. You know, like the, all three of their passer ratings last year were absolutely terrible. You know, they have a returning starter for 2 years and he probably doesn't have the job locked down. Like that's a problem. You know, their running backs, you know, averaged, their returning running backs averaged under 4 yards a carry last year. It is, you know, what did we just say about Byron Cardwell, right? That like, oh, Byron Cardwell better look out for his job because these other transfers who are coming in look real good. Byron Cardwell had 6.8 yards per carry. Like that's, it's a, you know, Oregon's returning running back had 6.8 yards per carry. It was a really good number. And it's like, I don't know, Byron, that might not be good enough to fend off the Western Kentucky kid. Like that's the like ruthlessness of competition in Oregon's running backs room, or the Minnesota guy, or the Hawaii guy, or the D2 guy. I forget where Cobbins is from, but I know it's D2. It's sort of like that's the standard. Or Sean Dollars, right? Who like who's coming off of an injury, and you know we don't know yet. But Sean Dollars easily, right? Would you be shocked if Sean Dollars won the job?
No. Like he's highly recruited, and more importantly, if you I think I read a tweet from him the other day. Yeah, I mean, he's just totally Oregon, totally on board Oregon. Yeah. We don't have to worry about his commitment to the process or to try to earn that starting job.
And meanwhile, our conversation with Gaby Lucas of UW Dog Pound, our sister site in the SB Nation network. We've been talking with Gaby for years. I always enjoy those conversations. She's maybe the only non-delusional Washington fan in existence. It's like what a remarkable find. Total unicorn. Almost the entirety of Gaby and my conversation about UW's running back room, it was, are Davis and Newton, their two returning running backs of the four-man rotation, are they salvageable? Like, or, you know, were there terrible numbers last year, a product of this and that, you know, the bad scheme and the bad offensive line? Or do these guys actually kind of suck? Like, do you have any question about Oregon running back room, you know, any of them, not just all, not all of them, like we were talking about with Washington, but any of them in Oregon's running back room? Like, maybe they kind of suck. Like, is that a concern for you for Oregon's running backs room?
No, no.
You know, where you need to like, I put like four bullet points in my article where I was breaking, it was talking about my film study. It was like, okay, I collected this stat and this stat and this stat and this stat, and I had to put it together. And, you know, my net output is that I think these guys aren't total garbage, maybe. Like, you know, are you worried about that with Byron Cardwell or Sean Dollars? You know, like that's like, I could do this for every single unit. Like for every single unit, I could go down where it's like the discrepancy, you know, between where these two teams are at is, you know, tight ends. They, you know, Washington lost Kate Otten, who was their total ace in the hole, right? Oregon loses. And they brought in his little brother, who's probably going to have to redshirt. Their, you know, number one tight end, Devin Culp, probably can't catch the ball. Their number two is a walk-on who can't block. Their number three is a project. There's another redshirt freshman who's also probably a project. Would you describe Terrence Ferguson, Maliki Matavau, and Spencer Webb in those terms?
Not at all.
No. And that's not even getting to Cam McCormick, who's really good if he's healthy. I swear. I mean, the last time we saw him was in 2017, but I wrote a whole article about that guy back in 2020. He's really good if he's healthy. And Patrick Herbert is a four-star and some pretty good bloodlines, you know, with that dude, too, if he's healthy. Like, you know, like, again.
Yeah,
you know,
I wouldn't be able to paint that in glowing terms at all, even if I was intoxicated with Kool-Aid.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, and I'm not joking. Like every one of these units that I could go down and compare where Oregon's at and where Washington is at, it's like, there's not a single unit for Washington that I would trade, you know, for Oregon's. And like here, I'll skip a bunch of these units and just go to the last one, which is defensive backs, which like that's the one room, right? Like over the last, better part of the last decade, if there was a room that you were going to swap, you know, if you were offered the trade Oregon's for Washington's, the one room you would have taken was their defensive backs, right?
Yeah.
You don't want Washington's cornerbacks this year. Like, I'm not joking about this. Their two starters are probably going to be walk-ons, and the guys behind them are four redshirt freshmen who haven't played. Of whom I think another one is a walk-on, and they're all, and the other, you know, and I think there's another walk-on in there. And there's an unrated JUCO transfer, and you know the scholarship guys are like mid three stars who've never played. It's like it's a complete, just yawning void of, you know, talent and experience. And like, look, those guys could turn out, you know, like I'm not saying that their fate is written in stone. Like we've all seen like guys come out of nowhere and be good. You know, it's just, this is a probabilities game. It's almost certain that's not going to happen. And so like Washington's cornerbacks room is going to go from the best and most experienced in the conference with, I'm not kidding about this, two first round draft picks, or one, they're both first round caliber, but only McDuffie was selected in the first round. Kyler Gordon fell all the way to the second round. They're going from the best and most experienced cornerbacks room in the conference to the least and least talented, least experienced and least talented, in the conference. And like the cornerbacks room was the tent, like that, I can tell you, like, that's the tent pole for their defense, and their defense is the main, it's a defense led program. And it's like that unit was the tent pole and the tent pole just got kicked out. Like, it, you know, like, what do you think is going to happen to that tent?
Yeah. Well, they'll be throwing shade on themselves.
Well, good job not mixing the metaphor. You know, like, I was sort of, for a minute there, I was sweating bullets about Oregon's cornerbacks room. But, you know, because of the departures, right? Like, Mikhail Wright, you know, left to try the NFL waters. DJ James transferred to Auburn, Jalen Davies, transferred to UCLA, where he will probably play right away, because if there's a defensive backs room that's more of a dumpster fire than Washington's right now, it's UCLA's. I will be publishing an article about them next week. That was a little sneak preview for everybody. But anyway, I was sort of sweating there. But then Dan Lanning got to work, right? Like, you know, got Christian Gonzalez out of the transfer portal, whom you have written about in a previous article with the defensive transfers, and got, you know, Jaleel and Jaleel, you know, out of San Diego, you know, as the freshman. And, you know, all of a sudden I'm like, hey, those guys plus Dante Manning, the five-star from the 2020 class, who was injured a little bit, and Avante Dickerson, who was a four-star true freshman last year. You know, Darren Barkins. There's also a walk-on who's gotten some spring game time. You know, Dondrell Brooks for depth. You know, like, okay, so there's seven probably playable guys, of whom you know, five are former four or five stars. Like, yeah, okay, you know,
yeah, we get some breathing room now.
Yeah, exactly. There, you know, is this the deepest cornerback room in the Pac-12? No, there's a couple more that are deeper. Is this, you know, this is a very talented and deep enough cornerbacks room. And like, I maybe would have wanted to trade it for like glory days Washington's cornerbacks. I'm not trading it for Washington's quarterbacks now or cornerbacks now. Like, it's just like, yeah. It's scary.
I got a question for you.
Yeah.
Since the rest of us are not about to watch a purple spring game, can you tell us some of the positives and negatives that you thought you kind of plucked from your viewing of it?
I think the biggest positive, that's way too backhanded for me to lead off with. I think here's the real biggest positive. I think their wide receivers are in good shape, which is a remarkable thing to say, because it's been so much turmoil. Their 2019 was a straight up bad season for their wide receivers. 2020 was weird. Of course, they only played four games. I sort of fast forward through that. But then in 2020, and then going into the 2021 season, they had five dudes transferred out, including Puka Nacua, who is like clearly their most talented dude. And it was sort of like, oh my God, this position's a disaster. But they sort of came out of all of that with like actually a very solid wide receiver core. They have two, you know, for real, legit, you know, receivers, Jalen McMillan and Roma Dunze. Are they the greatest wide receivers in the universe? You know, probably not, but they're definitely playable. That, you know, it was definitely the scariest part of Washington's offense last year. It was how they leveraged themselves out of the, you know, that what probably should have been a loss to Arizona and a couple other teams. Taj Davis is an inside, he's not an inside guy. Taj Davis looked good. The actual inside guy, Giles Jackson, who's also a sweet man, looks good too. Jalen Polk, who was their Texas Tech transfer, looked good before he got injured. And I can tell you from having watched that spring game, I may have been the only one. It was like me and a dozen people in the stands. he looked real good, but then he was injured. But then in the spring game, like, he looked back to healthy again. So that's like five returners who all look, you know, pretty good. Plus they got, Junior Alexander back from Arizona State. He was a Washington guy who went to Arizona State, didn't play, and now is back in Washington. He was a four-star. I saw him in the spring game. He looked fine too. I think their wide receiver core is actually pretty solid. Now, I don't know if they're going to have a quarterback who can throw to them, but like, yeah, you know, it was pretty good. I think their defensive line looks fine. I think they have one defensive tackle, Tuli Lutulianga-Sanoa, who is like legit good. And then I think they have, I'm not wild about the rest of the dudes, but they have enough depth that like they shouldn't have a problem with this, you know, defensive front. And like, unlike a couple other units where it's like, this might be a problem, I don't think they'll have a problem with defensive tackle. They have some like legit good dudes at defensive end as well. They don't have enough of them. Like, it's like, I think they're only going to have like, frankly, four playable guys, and one of them is going to be a redshirt freshman, and one of them is not going to be their five star, is my opinion. But like, okay, they have four, and I think those four will be pretty good. That's good news. Bad news, I think they only have four, and if like one guy gets hurt, that's potentially a big, you know, big problem. that's sort of, and then, okay, here was what I was going to say, but then decided it was too backhanded, but now it's time for the backhand. Their offensive line, they recruited a lot of really, really talented looking guys in the 2018, 2019, and 2020 seasons. I think 8 different dudes who were 4 stars, or it's like 7 4 stars and 1 really high 3 star who's like basically a 4 star. But we haven't seen any of them. Like, they have been sticking with the seniors and retreads and guys who like have not been playing well. And I've been waving that flag for a long time. And you know what usually happens when you're a super talented dude who is stuck and there's a bunch of guys with you, who you got to, and they're stuck behind, you know, senior Jags, and you got to, when it is finally going to be your turn, you got to compete against 6 other dudes who are also really talented and your same age. Like, you know what usually happens to guys like that?
If I was one of those players, I would really have a difficult time finding the motivation to really outperform, knowing that you've been burned before.
I mean, I would have a difficult time not just transferring, because you know what, that's something else I can tell you from doing this project. Every single one of the teams, or virtually every team that we talk to, will hold out a pie in the sky. Like, you know, I really think that our offensive line could do with, you know, an extra transfer or two. Like, maybe there's a 4 star who's just not happy where he's at, who transfer in. And every time when they say that, I either maintain control of myself and don't jump down their throat, or I lose control and then I jump down their throat and I say, forget it, dude, it's not going to happen. Like, 4-star offensive linemen who are actually good and playable do not get in the portal and are not coming to your school. But you know why? It's because Washington's hoarding all of them and none of them have transferred out. It's actually really, really remarkable. This is the backhanded part, like compliment part of this is like, it's really, What a compliment I have to pay to the University of Washington Huskies that their offensive line guys have not transferred out. They have actually stuck with the program, even though they're not getting any playing time and probably won't get any playing time in 2022. What high praise I have for these guys. They didn't transfer out. Or high praise for the Washington program for keeping them from transferring out. I did get to see them in the spring game, and they looked well. They looked how I would have expected them to look, which is you can see why they were 4 stars. They have the right frame for it. But you can also tell that they've never played a real college game, because when they were going up against defensive, defensive line players, who I just got done saying, you know, I thought that their defensive line looks pretty solid. They were getting beat, you know, in particular, the 2s, you know, were really just getting creamed by the defensive line. Now, that is not unusual to see in a spring game. Like, please don't anybody infer from that these guys are all busts. That's not an appropriate thing to take away from that comment. Defenses are usually ahead in the spring, if nothing else. But, you know, it's very clear that these guys, like, they're not like, we're not, we're not talking about Penei Sewell, you know, a guy who shows up as a true freshman in fall camp. He wasn't a spring enrollee. I think I'm going to have to check on that. But just like kicks everybody out of the room, becomes the starting left tackle. Like, yeah. I don't think, you know, I wasn't seeing a Penei Sewell among those guys. And I'm not really knocking them. 4-star offensive linemen in the Pac-12 who actually have the frame for it. Like, those are rare. And Washington should genuinely be happy that they have managed to keep all those guys in the fold, even though they've been there for like 4 or 5 years without playing. When they do play, I expect them to, you know, to be, you know, pretty decent. It's just that like, it's going to be like they play 1 year and then go to the NFL or graduate. You know, that's how long they've been, you know, Washington has been cooking this grenade a long time, and it might blow up in their hand. Like, it's, I hope that metaphor was not disturbing to too many people.
It's after the 4th of July. We're good.
Yeah, right. I hope nobody lost a finger over the holiday.
PTSD.
Yeah, no, we're whistled past that graveyard. Anyway, you know, that, like I said, this is kind of a backhanded compliment, but I think that their second string offensive linemen are, they were rated properly out of high school. They, when they finally take over, I think they will actually be good. My concern is, why aren't they taking over now? And are you going to only get like a year out of this guy? You know, because you've been waiting so long, like that.
Well,
you know,
maybe they're relying on the academic prowess at the University of Washington and graduating with that marketable degree.
Yeah, they could all be working at Costco next year.
That's right.
All right.
It's better than NIL for them. Okay.
Well, at the rate that Washington's collecting, I mean, that was the great, you know, irony was that, like, you know, Don James got drummed out of that program, or actually he quit in a huff because they weren't protecting him from, you know, because they were paying players. Like, Seattle was just like dumping tons of money on those guys. And like, as well, they might, like, I'm in favor of players being paid their market value. Like, I'm not, you know, trying to throw shade at Washington. It's just sort of like, it is a commentary on, you know, the culture of that program and its affiliates, that they, you know, they decided that we're going to be the squeaky clean, you know, or shit don't smell program. And so when NIL came along, like, they were singularly poorly situated to deal with it. You know, to the point where their athletic director is sending out holier than thou tweets, you know, as opposed to doing what she ought to be doing, which is organizing some NIL collectives to get some serious cash in people's pockets, you know.
Yep.
You know, regardless of what your stance is on the issue, like, you can't, you know, there's no atheists in foxholes, you know, like, there's, you know, you need to get with the program, guys, and you know, copping this attitude is not doing them any favors. Yeah, and it's just, it's,
and to be sure, NIL needs some concrete guidelines and barriers and this and that. Hasn't been worked out.
Yeah.
But still, it's, even when that comes to fruition, NIL is still going to be something that you have to work with and deal with.
And well, I guess what I'm trying to do is connect some dots here. Like, I'm not really trying to weigh in on the NIL issue or what regulations need to be adopted or, you know, whatever. What I am, you know, trying to talk about is that, like, you know, as I started out talking about, there's a real cultural contrast between Oregon and Washington, which is a remarkable thing to say. You actually, like, a lot of the ways that Oregon and Washington fans fight, like, I really sort of just see siblings fighting, where it's like they're fighting because they're very similar. And, you know, like, let's face it, like, Oregon and Washington, like, the states, you know, politically, culturally, you know, what things they're sensitive to, what things they don't care about, like, these are very similar states and these are fairly similar fan bases. But,
well, with that said, I have to say, I put my brother in the hospital a couple of times.
All right.
that's how we fought.
I meant on Twitter, which, for all the flaws of Twitter, people rarely come to fisticuffs over it. My point is that like, for all the similarities that these two fan bases ought to have, through choices that their coaches and athletic departments have made, they have at this point in history come to pretty different, you know, cultural values about what kind of talent that you acquire, what you do in order to acquire that talent, and when guys are supposed to be playing. And I see those dots connected all the time when I do any project reviewing Washington's roster. I see those cultural fingerprints all over the roster and the playing time. I see it in terms of the talent in and the talent out. For Washington versus Oregon, where Oregon's moving ahead and growing their average talent rating and Washington is falling behind and losing in their average talent rating. I see it in where playing time goes, where it's disproportionately for Washington going to older and less talented players and not to the young hotshots. And then that has knock-on effects. That has, you know, there's a virtuous circle there. Like, why would you want to be a young hotshot at Washington if you know you're going to have to ride the bench for 5 years, whereas the program on the other side of the Columbia River will say, you know what, if you come and prove that you're the best available guy, that we will play you and you'll be playing in the Rose Bowl.
And we're going to use you. Look at this player and this player and this player.
Yeah, look at all these exactly true freshmen. Yeah. Oh, Kayvon Thibodeau played as a true freshman and got drafted in the first round. Oh, you know, you don't say, et cetera, you know, whereas right. like, you know, you'd be hard pressed to find such a player, for Washington. They put a bunch of guys in the NFL, but it's, you know, it's not because those guys were super talented. It's because they sat, you know, they developed those guys over like 5 years, and like, good for them. I'm not really taking shots at that culture, but I am saying I can see effects of that attitude in the way that they then turn around and acquire talent, or more to the point, the way that they have not been.
Yeah. The way that they can acquire talent, because it's, as you say, if you're a hot shot, you look at that pattern and got to say no.
All right. I think that's going to do it for us this week. We'll wrap it up there. Any parting words for us, Badwater?
Nope. Just go Ducks. And this has been one of my favorite summers in Eugene in a long time, because it's still barely pushing past 80 degrees. And that's going to end next week.
Well, I hope everybody enjoys it and is able to stay cool. Maybe has a refreshing outdoor beverage. Thanks a lot, everybody. We'll catch you on the flip side.